As an unlicensed doctor, we suggest a prescription for one of our shows. Sign up for our free podcast at iTunes or with your favorite podcatcher. Fake Doctor's Orders. Sportsnet 590 The Fan on demand. Arash Madani wants Bob McCowan to know he appreciates the chance to guest host Primetime Sports. Bob wants Arash to know he had no knowledge of this, and he does not approve. Primetime Sports on the Sportsnet Radio Network.
Wednesday, May the 4th. Welcome to Primetime Sports. Arash Madani filling in for the vacationing Bob McCowan. John Shannon is here from 4 till 5 o'clock.
Let's get one thing straight.
Oh, here we go.
That's my Lloyd Benson, Dan Quayle. Nobody fills in for the Bob.
Right.
Okay?
Right.
You're sitting in the chair.
Just sliding in, keeping it warm.
There you go. Anyway, so I'm done now.
Are you sure?
Yeah, I am. Oh, okay. Aren't you in a good mood?
I'm in a great mood.
Oh, what a time to be a sports fan in Canada.
What a night. What a 40 seconds that was.
oh, it was longer than that. But it was
right.
So, I mean, but yes. Yeah, I know. How do you do it? Some of us have three TVs going.
Right.
How do you do it when you only have one?
So you had...
three TVs.
You had which games on? You had the Blue Jay game, you had the basketball game, and...
No, I actually had the... I did because I had my computer going too with the second hockey game.
Okay.
So I had the basketball, baseball, and then hockey.
Right.
So I'll go on.
The Lowry shot, actually, I got off my seat.
You did, huh?
I did.
Wow.
I didn't see it coming a mile. I actually thought he stepped out of bounds coming down the left wing.
And did he?
I think he did. I think he did.
But... he didn't have the ball, did he, at that point, or no?
See, it was pretty tight.
Yeah, that would have been interesting.
It's not the football rule where you can't go out of bounds and then come back in.
What is if you do it to avoid, there is a bit of a similar situation in basketball, to avoid a situation, like particularly on the baseline, but on the sideline maybe not as much.
Maybe not.
So, but no, it was
so Lowry hit it, and then 40 seconds later, Justin Smoke with the walk-off.
Yeah. Well, and... when you consider that the two home runs by Smoke,
right,
in back to back innings, to me that it was a fun night just to sit around and not work too hard.
Yeah, no kidding.
And quite frankly, the one series in hockey that I thought was going to be the drabbest was the best game last night, and the other two that I thought were going to be competitive were fait accompli quite soon in my mind.
Right,
well, Nashville just. Mauled San Jose at home. Just was a different team. And then St. Louis did what I think a lot of people expected them to do to Dallas at home. But the Tampa Islander game, holy smokes, what a game that was, too. That was up and down.
In overtime, Tampa wins it on a Brian Boyle goal. We'll talk some more baseball coming up a little later with Buck Martinez. Lots of hoops conversation coming up
after 5 o'clock. What do you make of LeBron?
Saying he wants...
well, stoking the fires that he's going to play Miami and D Wade and
yeah,
what do you make of that?
Well, why wouldn't he say that?
Well, except that LeBron I thought would be a little smarter this early, but then what the heck, you know.
And to be fair, I didn't see how the question was kind of posed to him and how it was framed,
right?
Because it's really easy to
take a quote,
right? Are you looking forward to getting another chance at your old team? Did you watch D Wade the last couple of nights? How that would go?
Boy, has he been good! Oh, like, and not to take last night by itself, but Sunday against Charlotte, and Arash, it's one of those times where in any sport that you and I cover, you look at veteran leadership,
yeah,
and you look at someone that can go out and back it up. So, and he, every team wants that out of their veteran guys.
It's outside of the Raptors-Indiana series. The first round series that I watched the most was that Miami-Charlotte series.
Really, huh?
And, you know, Miami goes up 2-0, and you're saying to yourself, okay, this is going to be a sweep. And then Charlotte wins the next three, and you're saying, all right, it's a legit thing over there in Buzz City. And Friday night, after the Raptors lost to Indiana, I'm watching that Charlotte-Miami game.
Mm-hmm.
And Dwayne Wade, who hadn't hit a three in forever,
yeah,
who was kind of, you know, set aside and kind of being ready to be put out to pasture, takes over the end of that fourth quarter, and he has not looked back.
Yeah.
Miami was done. Miami was finished. They were in Charlotte. The Hornets were on the brink, and Dwayne Wade just didn't let it happen.
Yeah, and that's that veteran ability and leadership that when you will your way and will your teammates' way. I mean, even last night when he's in the huddle.
Yeah.
I mean, there wasn't very much Eric Spoelstra. There was a ton of Dwayne Wade ripping his teammates for what had happened and how this was not going to happen. And I suppose the Raptors had spent so much energy getting it back to the tie.
Right.
That the one team was ready for overtime and the other one was spent.
I remember going to a Blue Jay game a few years ago, and they won it in the ninth inning when Jose Bautista gunned the runner out from right field.
Mm-hmm.
The walk-off defensive play.
Sure.
And, you know, to me, I love great defense in any sport. Give me a pick six to win a football game. Give me, you know, the Bautista throw was terrific. Last night, there's D. Wade, DeRozan with a chance to tie it again, and there he is stripping DeMar,
yeah,
making the defensive play, taking it for the and one. I mean, it's one thing to get it done offensively, but then to do it on the defensive end to win a game, to me is, John, if not as significant, maybe even more.
And you know what? We almost saw that Sunday as well.
Right.
Paul George was close to doing that Sunday as well, when you think about that one play at midcourt where he stripped the ball and went back the other way. It's an interesting series. I mean, far from over, obviously. I mean, stay on the bandwagon, folks. If you're a Raptors fan, staying on the bandwagon. But man, oh man, does the series hinge on game two? Does it hinge on game two?
Does the series hinge on Kyle Lowry?
Well, I don't care who it. I mean, listen, I mean. There have been nights where in the last series that Lowry still wasn't, you know, as present as he should be, that DeRozan was able to, even if he shot 28%, got 30 points.
Yeah.
I mean, there has to be a way that this team can will its way to a victory, you know, with guys like Patterson and Joseph and others doing their jobs. I mean, Terrence Ross at times last night, a couple of great moves.
He was the ignition to the whole thing last night. Yeah. T. Ross of all guys.
Yeah, well, thank goodness they had a little bit of that last night from a different angle. I mean, it's, as I said, this is, you get to Thursday night with this team. I mean, does Miami cruise and say we got our one win on the road? This is the NBA, and you know it is better than I do. The NBA and road victories, what kind of momentum, what kind of impetus does a road victory have in trying to win a series? Does it have any? Does it have much? I know in the NHL, road victories, I think, have a lot to say,
mm-hmm,
for a team that wins a series.
I think it will when you get to the conference final, especially the San Antonio Golden State,
yeah,
impending matchup. But at this
point, hold on now. It's 1-1 over.
I know.
It's 1-1.
I know.
See, how do you go against anything, you know, Russell and Kevin do? I mean, how do you do it?
Right.
They're pretty good.
Yeah.
They're fun to watch.
You're
getting ahead of yourself just like LeBron.
I'm getting yes, I am. However, Tim Duncan can't be that bad. The Spurs can't be that bad. It amazes me how a team can lose by 40 and then win the next game by one.
Going back 36 hours or whatever it is when you think about the panic that occurred for the Spurs at the end of the game, even though the NBA admitted there should have been five fouls called.
Right.
At the end of the end of game two there.
It's becoming an issue, though, in the NBA. And I like the accountability.
You do, huh?
Because I think fans deserve to know.
Yeah, I understand that. But, you know, we have created this new genre of sports discussion about suspensions and fines and head hits and fouls. And the NBA and the NHL approach it a little differently.
Mm-hmm.
But it almost creating that second tier of discussion. Maybe I'm too old school at times, but boy, oh boy, are they! When they say we missed five fouls, I'd like to know what the referees union feels about that.
Right. I thought Chris Webber was terrific though, because it was a blatant missed call.
Oh yeah,
it was the inbound. Sure. It was the nudge in. It should have been a foul, and Webber instantly recognized it and went off on it. And I mean, Sean, you've gone down this road. We're going to bring in Richard Deitch from Sports Illustrated in a little bit. I think this is an interesting conversation because good for Webber for pointing it out.
Mm-hmm.
But when you're a rights holder, you're a partner with a league. So where is the delicate line between not disparaging what's happening on the floor, the questioning the competence of the officials, but also pointing out exactly what happened here and exactly what went wrong?
Well, there is a way to do it without disparaging.
Mike Pereira has done that so well in football.
Well, but listen, the National Football League have the greatest media police in the history of mankind. The goal of a rights holder is to be as fair as possible and to want people to watch the next game.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, if you tell people how bad things are time and time again, people are going to turn it off on you. And you don't really want that. You want them to come back and say, wow, this is exciting. I want to watch again. The whole concept of being fair in your commentary as opposed to negative. And there's a big difference between being fair and being negative. Simply because if they say, well, this is horrible. Well, it's not horrible. Yeah. Nothing's ever horrible. It's easy to be negative. It's very difficult to be fair. And that discussion point, I'm sure, goes on every day in every network office with league officials, mm-hmm, in many ways.
I think back to the one moment where the rubber really met the road. And it was a long time ago. As we welcome in Richard Deitch from Sports Illustrated. Richard, you'll remember the Monday nighter, Green Bay, Seattle, the Hail Mary, the replacement officials. One referee signals touchdown. The other referee signals touchback. The temperature at that point was so high.
Sure.
From fans, from the media, of these replacement refs. And something gave then. Something happened then, and 2 days later, the regular referees were back to work. What do you make of a guy like Chris Webber, you know, pointing out the missed call that blatantly the other night at the end of the OKC San Antonio game?
Well, first, good to be with you. I did check my contract. I'm allowed to be on with someone other than Bob.
Nice, so nice.
You have a contract?
It's a handshake agreement.
I gotcha.
A handshake agreement written in Sanskrit.
Okay.
Nice. Well, my university degree is written in crayon, so there you go.
Exactly. Aren't we all? First of all, I absolutely like the fact that Chris Webber was critical of the referees. I personally don't think there's enough of that. If you remember, you cited that Monday Night Football game. If you remember, one of the things that became a big news story was just how hard John Gruden, if I remember right, was on that play. Mm-hmm. I think he was the analyst on that with Tirico, and that, you know, that created a lot of pressure on the league to get that situation fixed. I don't think it happens enough. Personally, I heard what John said. I think television networks are enablers of leagues more than anything else. I think it's a closed shop. I think a lot of these broadcasters are friends or friendly with those in league offices that they, in theory, should be covering.
Mm-hmm.
But essentially, they are just partners. And so when a Webber does something like that, it's very refreshing to me because it's reflective of what I think it's reflective of what I am watching as a viewer and what I would like my broadcaster to be delivering. And that's some kind of truth and accuracy. And if something happens in that game that where the referees, who it's a very hard job, but when the referees make a mistake, I would like my broadcasters to say that. Where you go on the other side and where it gets ridiculous, obviously, is when you have homers and someone like Tommy Heinsohn, who is sort of colorful and lovable, but he's famous for this. You know, the refs are always bad every night. They screwed this call up.
Sure.
That's where it gets a little ridiculous. But I thought Weber, that it's important in big playoff games for a broadcaster to be on that.
Yeah.
Your job is to reflect this to the viewer. Your job, this is my opinion. Your job is not to always sell the soap for the league. So you need some honesty in the booth every now and then.
No, and I agree, but I think that there's a fairness doctrine, and the fairness doctrine is to find a way to say it without being condescending. And that's what I would, because I do. I mean, if it's blatantly obvious that there's a mistake, you have to admit there's a mistake. You have to call the mistake. But you can do that in such a manner, Richard, that the viewer at home doesn't, who isn't necessarily. I mean, the problem that we have in our industry is you have three sets of fans, fans of the home team, fans of the visitors team, or just the casual fan who has no stake at the game. So you have to find a way to make sure two of those three are always at least prepared to watch, and at the same time, don't insult the other one. So that's the fine line. And I'm not suggesting that for 1 minute you smooth it over and say this is wrong and or it's not as bad as it looks. What I am saying is that there's lots of guys that go out there and more at the local level than the national level, like a Heinsohn, like a Hawk Harrelson in Chicago, that go out and just, you know, are blatantly biased and will rip the game as a whole, even if it just is to protect their own team.
I agree with that. And a lot of times they're being pointed by ownership to provide that kind of broadcast and to be homers above all. Mm-hmm. And a lot of people make their careers and fame, like Harrelson did, with that kind of stuff. The interesting thing, having talked to a lot of national guys over the years, is, and I do agree with you in some sense, John, that they are really aiming to win the fan that's in the middle, the fan that is the person who is not necessarily attached to either team, but is watching it from a fairly objective viewpoint. Because in the end, there's always going to be a bias for the hardcore fan who thinks you're calling it against their team. The irony of all this is most national people really are not rooting at all. They're really independent contractors who are just calling the game and don't necessarily have any kind of rooting interest with the teams that are being played. But I will say that, again, sort of covering this space, the thing about analysts in particular, and let's use the NFL as the best example, I never really know what they're telling me in terms of what they really know. What they're describing on the field, I think they're on the up and up, and they're straight shooters on that. But because it's really hard to fake that because we're all seeing it.
Sure.
But I'll give you a perfect example. John Gruden is doing a Redskins game. I have no idea what he knows about the Redskins game plan, what he knows about team issues going on the Redskins. His brother obviously coaches the team. And I think that's apparent a lot of times in analysts around the league. It's kind of as a viewer what you're really not being told, but these guys really know, versus what goes on the air. And that's always what concerns me. And then that gets back to, you know, who are you working for? Who are your allegiances really to? And are they to the viewer first and foremost, or are they to the apparatus of the NFL or specific teams? And, you know, I don't want to try to come off too cynically, but I always feel that they don't – the best people have my interest as a viewer at heart, but I think the majority of the people have either their own interest, the league interest, or the team's interest at heart.
So to that point, because I totally agree with you about the Gruden situation and the Van Gundy situation.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm to the point where if I was actually in a place of decision-making, and I'm not, I would say that John Gruden can't do a Redskin game. I would say that Jeff Van Gundy can't do a Detroit game because of his brother being the coach across the court.
And TNT has not had Kevin McHale do a Houston game this spring.
And yet ESPN loves to put Mark Jackson in the Golden State Warriors' backyard.
Correct.
So it's a fascinating, I mean, whether that's to create conflict or they don't feel there's any other option. But I think it's really important when we get to that level at high stakes games to get rid of any of that question of conflict of interest.
I agree with you. The executives at ESPN would disagree with you strongly.
Of course they would.
Right? And what they would say is that our announcers are professional. We like the fact that there's a connection to somebody who's in the game. They probably like the buzz that you can even sort of play off it public relations-wise with it. But I totally agree with you. The problem for American television, at least, is this has been going on forever, from Bob Greasy calling Brian Greasy's games, to Bill Walton calling Luke Walton's games, to Darryl Waltrip in the booth calling Michael Waltrip's races. It's been going on forever. Networks always do it. They don't seem to care at all about the potential conflict of interest, so it's not going to change. I remember, I think it was either last year or the year before, where I asked an ESPN executive about this, and they essentially like laughed, which sort of tells you, if I would have asked the question 10 years ago, they would have taken it seriously and spun me. But at this case, it was almost a laughter, like, what are you talking about? No viewer cares about that stuff. So that's the sort of the thinking generally when it comes into the executive suite. They don't even see it as a conflict anymore. They see it as a marketing opportunity. But I'm with you, John. I mean, to me, you would owe it to your viewer, I think, to eliminate any potential appearance of conflict of interest just on the optics.
Totally.
But that's not how these guys see it.
Richard Deitch joins us from Sports Illustrated. Richard, it's amazing what the NFL draft has become. Last Thursday, yet again, I mean, made-for-TV stuff that just took on a life of its own with the drama, with the Laremy Tunsil situation. I'm intrigued talking to a former television executive. Some may say around this building he still is a television executive.
Stop it.
And a television critic, how that was handled by both ESPN and NFL Network. You wonder how much there was the thought of, do we pursue this, not knowing if it was the actual kid behind the mask or not? How did you guys both see that shaking down?
You go first, Richard.
Yeah, I was going to say, first of all, I think I believe John is producing PTS secrets.
Oh, yes. God. Thank God McCowan's out of the country.
In terms of, Arash, in terms of that story, which, I did my column on that, and I talked to a news editor at ESPN who's been, he's been at 25 NFL drafts. He's been in the ESPN truck for 13 years. He said he's never seen a more crazy story, and how could you? I mean,
sure.
Kid's account is hacked, Instagram account hacked.
Minutes of the draft beginning and continuing.
Yeah, I mean, you have issues of computer piracy. You have issues potentially of blackmail. You have a guy who's legitimately losing millions of dollars in real time, and you have two news organizations trying to figure out what on earth is going on. I actually thought both the NFL Network and ESPN did a pretty good job here in the sense that they were cautious in terms of naming Tunsil as the person in the video. We all assumed it, but you can't, you need to confirm it somewhere, whether with him or someone else. And I thought they used pretty good judgment early in terms of not placing the video on air before they knew what was going on. And then initially did the steps of reporting that you needed to do, try to talk to his agent, try to talk to Tunsil, figure out, what's real and what's not. Amazingly enough, someone who I think is a terrible broadcaster, self-serving to the nth degree, Deion Sanders, I thought, did an amazing job of interviewing Tunsil live after he was picked.
I agree.
He asked the right questions to get some answers out of him, including the confirmation that he was indeed in the video. My one criticism of these networks, it's totally Monday morning quarterback, and I have great respect for the people who are in the truck and how much work is being done to draft. These are 16, 17-hour days. It's a very hard thing to cover. And I just thought the people on the set were a little bit moralizing and finger-wagging over the marijuana issue, but never really sort of thinking about, here's a kid who had his privacy violated. And imagine if your social media feed somebody got into and just started screwing around with your life. So I thought there was a lot of moralizing about, he's a 20-year-old kid. He's got to grow up. It's not mature to do marijuana, blah, blah, blah. However you feel about marijuana, whatever. But they were just, to me, dismissing a big part of that was that somebody, most likely an adult, really like sabotaged this kid and cost him millions of dollars. To me, that was the story. We still haven't figured out who it was. And I thought that that was missed by both networks in lieu of what you obviously knew was going to happen. Football guys talking about character, et cetera.
The one, a couple of things, because what you said makes a ton of sense, Richard. The one, the part that I would suggest is, and this is a lot different than having your news department do it. Sports is a sandbox. Sports, respectfully, is not journalism. People can pretend to be journalists, but it's not journalism. It is, I mean, the guy you're talking about, Todd McShay, went on a tangent, and you're saying, well, hold on, well, that's not responsible journalism.
And what Todd McShay said was Tunsil's misstep here was telling the truth.
And so that's a really hard thing for people in the sports world, in the media world, to understand that for the most part, people that are in those TV mobiles, those and producing those types of events in the heat of the moment are not journalists. They are not. We expect them to be. So that then the question becomes is how do we expect them to be, and what is the fallback position to allow them to become journalists, or that the journalists come in and take over?
But to that point, are there, though. Schefter is there. Rappaport is there. They are the journalists. They are newspaper men who are now working on television.
Okay, that's your opinion. I respect that. The other key thing is that the draft is so choreographed.
Yes.
The draft is so choreographed. 3 minutes for this, 2 minutes for the feature, 2 minutes for analysis, get the next pick out. If somebody threw you a curveball 4 minutes into your show, your head would explode.
Right.
And I can speak from that perspective, I can speak from experience. So those two things, it would be very difficult. Even in an hour and a half, which probably got to the point where Tunsil was almost drafted by Miami, that they could be in a position to really follow up properly. I thought they actually reacted quite well in the short term, but the whole concept, and this is where your expectation, Richard, is certainly the correct one, but in the reality of how these groups work, there are times that I say, hey, listen, we're not in the journalism industry. We aren't. We're in the sports and entertainment industry at times. You know, and I know that's disconcerting to some people, but in many ways it's the reality.
I would say this, and I think Arash brought it up. I do. The one thing I would take issue with you, John, is that I do think there are delineations, even on a television broadcast, between who is practicing journalism, who is not, who's a journalist, and who is not. And I think Arash is totally right. In that situation, Adam Schefter, Ian Rappaport, Chris Mortensen, information brokers, this is what they do. They practice journalism on a daily basis. Is it as important or hard journalism as those who are in Syria right now? Of course not. But they are journalists, and they are practicing what journalism does. Where I think all this – as, by the way, I think what Arash and I do are journalism every day. Where this gets very tricky, and you brought the right point up – is when you put someone like Tom McShay in a journalistic position, which is the inevitable large conflict of ESPN as a whole, because on every given day, the lines are very weirdly morphed between what's an analyst, what's a journalist. A perfect example is this. This is where ESPN's total BS cynicism comes in. When ESPN wants to push Stephen A. Smith as a basketball journalist breaking news about basketball transactions, they push him as a journalist. When he's on a show like First Take, giving bloviating opinions, now he's a commentator. Now he doesn't fall under the same rubric and rules of journalism. So at one place, this is all a car wreck, because you have – not only do you try to figure out who's a journalist and who's not, sometimes the own network is spinning the public as to when a singular person is a journalist and a singular person is not. So – I think it could be very confusing for viewers.
Totally.
But I would say, as Arash said, the reason why people like Schefter and Rappaport, and the Albert Breers and the Michael Silvers and Aditi Kinkawalas, they're all journalists. I mean, the NFL Network and ESPN will tell you this is a news-gathering operation, and if that's the case, there has to be a lot of journalism going on at the NFL draft.
Well, one guy we know is not a journalist is Curt Schilling. And it came out this week that he and his representatives approached Fox Fox, Richard, of all networks. And Fox turned Curt Schilling down?
Well, I think, you know, at a certain point, there's opportunity cost here. And they've spent a lot of money on Colin Cowherd and Skip Bayless and Jason Whitlock. And they've also been asked to cut costs. So they've had a lot of people who have taken buyouts, and they have they haven't re-signed some sideline reporters and some other people. So if you're Fox, and a guy who ostensibly is a baseball analyst comes in and says, "Are you guys interested in me?" Even if Fox sort of is aligned with him, his political orthodoxy, they have like 10 baseball analysts. Sure. So his main job, you're not really slotting him in. You know, you already have like Eric Karros and Frank Thomas and Pete Rose, or and on the, you know, on the games you have John Smoltz, obviously, and Verducci on the second team. So there's not really a spot at Fox for Schilling. And then you counter, okay, would we hire this guy just as an opinionist? And my guess is somebody there made a decision that they didn't think he could carry a show as just a straight opinionist talking multiple sports.
Makes sense. Makes sense. Richard, we appreciate this, man. And I think the moral of the story is, I mean, I'm of a certain age. I'm only in my mid-30s. I graduated from university in 2002. I'm just grateful there weren't camera phones around when I was in college.
Same here. The one thing that always stood out to me about this whole thing, I'll just make it quick, is that Tunsil grew up in an age where kids, and many people I'm sure listening to this show know, your whole life you live on camera. You live online. You live on video. Mm-hmm. That wasn't the case with us or Rosh, and that's where – it's almost like Tunsil didn't understand the disconnect of being filmed. He was laughing when he was filmed because I think as a 20-something, he lived his whole life on his phone. But there are ramifications when video like that gets out.
Yeah. No, we appreciate it. Absolutely. The days of the consequence-free environment are over, especially on college campuses.
Definitely.
Okay, Richard. Thanks.
Thanks, guys.
It is an interesting balance, though, between journalism and production.
And rights holders. I'm sorry. It's a hard. I mean, the line gets blurred. The line isn't straight. Who made a bigger gaffe? I don't know. We got to go. But who made a bigger gaffe during Deflategate than Chris Mortensen?
Right.
When he believed someone who and what happens is that league sources give you information and you use it.
And guys you trust.
Guys you trust.
Whew. And it blew up on him.
Yeah.
32 minutes past the hour. We're going to take a quick timeout. Eugene Melnyk, the owner of the Ottawa Senators, is going to join us. They have a new downtown arena. It's becoming closer and closer to reality. And who may the new head coach of his Ottawa Senators be? We'll discuss that with Melnyk coming up right here on Primetime Sports.
Did Bob McCown just say what I think he said? You can rewind Primetime Sports Podcast when you subscribe at iTunes or with your favorite podcatcher. Sportsnet 590 The Fan, on demand. On demand. On demand.
Now more of what you want to hear
on Sportsnet 590, The Fan.
The show's much more mellow with you on.
Yeah, no kidding. It's 4:41, it's Primetime Sports. Arash Madani keeping the seat warm for Bob McCowan. John Shannon here until 5 o'clock when Damian Cox will
keeping
pop
the seat
by.
Warm for Damian Cox.
And that's it. Blue Jays Rangers, they split the first two of their series. Aaron Sanchez, Colby Lewis tonight. No real changes to the Blue Jays lineup. Ryan Goins will start at second base. He'll hit ninth. Of course, John Gibbons announcing they'll do some kind of a platoon with him and Darwin Barney. So Lewis and Sanchez coming up after Primetime Sports, both on the radio and on Sportsnet.
And just one hockey game tonight, huh?
Penguins Capitals.
Yeah.
What have you made of that so far?
I think it's Penguins. I really do. I picked them to win the Stanley Cup. I've always wondered whether there was enough there for the Caps, if they can shut the Backstrom line down. And what Pittsburgh has done is they've sacrificed Crosby to shut the line down. And in many ways, it's been a pretty good trade-off for Mike Sullivan. So you look at the Bonino line with Hagelin and Kessel doing their damage. And then Kuznetsov on the Washington side not being able to do, whether it's inexperience or, you know, he hasn't been very productive. Justin Williams has played on the edge and sometimes over the edge.
Right.
Trying to will his way and will his teammates' way to win. And then, the story tonight will be how the Penguins are able to adapt without Chris Letang in the lineup.
Mm-hmm.
And, I mean, who's going to take, is it Brian Dumoulin and a few of those guys that are going to take that load? It'll be a tough one for the Penguins to win tonight,
though. One game suspension for Chris Letang. It's the Penguins and the Capitals. That's on CBC. The Blue Jays and the Rangers on Sportsnet, and right here on Sportsnet 590, The Fan. The project is Rendezvous Le Breton. To many in the National Capital Region, it's something that should have been done, back when the franchise was founded, but no longer in Canada. 5 years from now, they will be building down at the National Capital Commission area of town in Le Breton Flats. Eugene Melnick is the owner, governor, and chairman of the Ottawa Senators. He joins us on Primetime Sports. Eugene, was the first emotion relief? Was it joy? What was it when you finally realized this project was going to be a reality?
I was stunned. I really, kind of prepared myself that this was not going to happen. And I think that's just a way of, surrounding yourself with protection to not be so disappointed, because it's something we really wanted to do. But we couldn't count on it. It was a complete secretive type of process, and you thought you were doing the wrong thing, but it's not like somebody's checking you along the way and saying, yeah, that's right, keep doing here, go there. But in the end, it was a surprise. It was a pleasant surprise, and the first thing I thought of, that's they just added 2,000 hours to my workload over the next 2 years. So that was it.
So, Eugene, what's happened since the announcement all the way to today? This was not necessarily 100% given. You still have to negotiate with the Capital Commission, correct?
That's correct. We met with them the very next day, and basically at that point you sit down and you walk through the process, how long it's going to take, what's going to be required from us to get to the next step and move things along, which we did. And it was a very, very good meeting. And it was a nice, there was a nice tone to it in that, everybody meant business, but it was like, let's get going, and we really want to do this. And all the people at NCC, they want to see this done, and I think everybody wants to get this thing done. So I can't wait to we've already begun. We're working all day on this.
What in the end, I mean, this is more than just an arena. This is a whole complex, a community, in fact. In the end, was this the determining factor whether the Senators would survive in Ottawa or not?
There's a lot of things that go into making a hockey team run. One of them, the most important, is actually performance. And if you can start consistently going deep into the playoffs, or even in the playoffs, for that matter, then, you'll get the attendance, and with that you'll get the revenues, and then you'll get the salaries, and everything just keeps moving right along. Our stadium out in Canada is nice. It just—it's 25 years old, and that's the lifespan of these things. 23 years old, and ultimately, we have to either put $100 million into it, and these things aren't cheap. I mean, you build one of these, it's $500 million. That's a lot of dough for a stadium.
Yeah.
But it is what it is. That's what it is now, and we'd have to put a lot of money into a new stadium, and the question becomes, well, is that a smart move out there, and we continue battling out there, or do we do something else? And, I guess that was determined for us when we won the rights to continue negotiating on a priority basis with the NCC.
With Senators owner Eugene Melnick. Eugene, you have yourself a new general manager. You don't have yourself a coach. The Calgary Flames fired Bob Hartley yesterday. Bruce Boudreau had been dismissed a few days prior. There are a lot of, the rumor mill has been swirling since. What can you tell us about where you are with your coaching search at this point?
I think for us, we're down to the last couple of interviews, if that. And Pierre basically just updated me and said that he's almost done. And we're planning a call on Friday, and then we go into next week. I'm coming into town, and we'll see what we do with you know, who is going to be on that final list. But it's been progressing since the day we had to start and the day we could start. And it's gone well. There's some great talent. There's some really...
Oh, we just lost Eugene Milne.
There's Pierre Dorion saying, we don't want you to talk about this stuff. You know, come on.
That was interesting. So they're down to the last couple of interviews, if that.
But this is phase one still. I mean, I talked to Pierre on Saturday, and he had already interviewed five.
Mm-hmm.
He did not know at that point that Hartley was available.
Right.
There was still another interview that was on his list that hadn't been done. So that's the two more. So that's phase one of being able to go and say, here's our hot list. And then sitting down with Eugene when he gets back to the Capitol.
So Eugene, when you put you have your call on Friday, you put together a final list. How many names are on that final list by the end of this week?
I'll see two.
Okay.
That's it. Basically, it's Pierre's decision, but at the end, it's top two that he likes, and then. But at the end, he's got to live with it, so let him do it. That's what he gets paid for. So,
but that's interesting. In the process, though, if you know, if the two names were Arash and me, would you then say, okay, I want to talk to both the guys?
I think he'd fold up shop.
Well, I know. I know the power play'd be better, but other than that, do you expect to talk to both of the candidates, Eugene?
Yes.
Okay. What do you expect to get out of that interview other than just a confirmation of what Pierre sees?
Just a confirmation of what Pierre sees. And, you know, by that time, I'm fully knowledgeable about the individual. Mm-hmm. I know of every one of them that's been interviewed. And, you know, those that have been are very well known, and it's very public of who they are.
Mm-hmm.
And that's it. So it's really more of a casual meeting. I'm the last guy to blow it with.
Right.
I mean, you'd have to do something really sad to blow it with me. I'm just honest to God. You're in unless you blow it.
Yeah.
You gotta really blow it somehow. Yeah. But I think I will go with Pierre's recommendation regardless. But it's just nice to meet both.
Sure.
And give my view.
Eugene, you got to game six of the playoffs last year in round one before running into Carey Price. You're on the outside looking in this season. With the new coach, is there an expectation of reaching the playoffs next year?
Yes, absolutely. First question.
Yeah.
Is this a playoff team? And he's got to have the right answer. He's got to believe it. That's the main thing. Don't just tell me because I'll be at you at game 75.
Mm-hmm.
But...
You want the truth, though.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. He says, no, you don't. You don't have have a playoff team.
Okay.
That's fine. What do we do?
Yeah, exactly. Okay.
And what do I need?
Perfect.
And if Pierre, he sits there and concurs, you get it.
Hey,
what we need? Hey, it's no secret what we need. I mean, we're microscoped up in Ottawa. It's no different than the Leafs. Everybody knows what everybody needs.
Yeah, you're right.
So just go get them.
One final question on the arena. What happens, and maybe this is premature, what happens to Canadian Tire Centre?
You know, there's so many ideas, people flying around. Some are, you know, cost $900 million, and that's not going to go. but there's so many different options for us. What we need to do is make sure whatever we do sticks around. The people of Canada have been really good to us. The whole town has just grown with us. I've been there for 13, 14 years.
Sure.
Done nothing. I have nothing but great things to say about that city, and we're going to make sure we leave them right. That's all.
Eugene, we thank you very much for this. Congratulations on the LeBreton Flats decision, and good luck with that coaching search. Make sure whoever you hire doesn't screw it up, huh?
You got it. Okay, take care.
Eugene Melnyk, the owner, governor, and chairman of the Ottawa Senators, who look to be having a new coach very soon.
Yeah, it sounds like next week, which surprises me. I mean, I didn't think it was going to be this quickly.
John, thank you so much. Damian Cox about to slide in for the last 2 hours. Lots of Raptors talk, some Blue Jays conversation, all coming up on Primetime Sports on the Sportsnet Radio and Television Networks.